Today on Against the Grain, the number of self-described foodies has multiplied, but can a good, clean, and fair food system be constructed within and under capitalism? In his new book, Eric Holt Jimenez examines the role of agriculture and food systems in the historical development of capitalism. He also assesses the power and potential of the food movement. I'm CS. The director of Food First discusses food, agriculture, and political economy. Coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. What do food and agriculture have to do with political economy? What do food systems and agricultural arrangements and land fertility and the treatment of people who work the land, what do these things have to do with economic regimes and political ideologies and the development and dynamics of capitalism? In the eyes of Eric Holt Jimenez, our current corporate food regime must be replaced with an equitable and resilient system. And that, he says, requires changing everything. And that requires an understanding of the structures of neoliberal capitalism that dictate what we grow, what we eat, and what's happening to rural land and rural populations. Eric Holt Jimenez directs the Institute for Food and Development Policy, known as Food First, and for more than two decades he worked with peasant movements in Mexico and Central America. He's authored and edited a number of books, and his new book is A Foodie's Guide to Capitalism, Understanding the Political Economy of What We Eat. When Eric Holt Jimenez joined me recently in studio, I asked him what he was hoping to do with this book.
What I wanted to do with this book is really start with some political economic literacy for the food movement. I think that the food movement writ large has gotten to a place where it's starting to have a political impact and can begin thinking about political strategy. In the United States especially, I think we're really crippled by a lack of concepts and terminology that allows us to engage forcefully politically. And so this book is about political economy, and it's, you know, using the C word out loud because we have to, we need to realize this is a capitalist food system. It's going to act the way capitalism acts. And if we want to change a capitalist food system, then we better understand capitalism. So that's what the book is for.
In chapter one, you describe the three global food regimes that have emerged historically. And it begins, this first chapter, with the role of agriculture in capitalist development and with the so-called enclosures that occurred in the British Isles. When and how did enclosures happen?
So if you go back to the 16th century, we begin to see the emergence of industry. And industry needs raw materials. In this case, the industry needed wool for the spinning looms in the cities that were being built. And they had a lot of difficulty getting enough supply because the peasantry was growing food. And yeah, they had some sheep out there, but they basically, you know, carded and spun their own stuff and sold a little bit on the market. And whatnot. Not enough for this industrial leap. So what happened was that the large landed gentry saw an opportunity. They basically shoved the peasantry off the land in order to put sheep on it. And the way they did that was first to enclose the commons. That's what we call them, the enclosures. And by enclosing the commons, privatizing the commons, something which goes on still today, peasants no longer had access to fuel and fodder and medicinal plants and couldn't graze their animals on the commons anymore. So, and this was an important part of peasant economy and village life. So they then had to work for wages. The other thing that happened was they got taxed. And so having to come up with money and not being able to rely on their full economy, they were forced to go to the cities to work. And they were also forced to then work on the larger, what became at that time, something close to plantations.
So there was a kind of consolidation of land ownership at the time?
Tremendous consolidation of land ownership. And this really characterizes capitalism. This is what Marx calls primitive accumulation, or original accumulation, some people call it. But it's that where you basically, the bourgeoisie, or the industrial class, or whomever it happens to be, could be a mercantile class as well, steals, appropriates, expropriates, and dispossesses people and villages and communities of their wealth. And in this case, the wealth was in the land, and so that's what they took, and that's what they needed. And so tremendous consolidation took place, which then creates this huge reserve army of labor. What's important to understand is that people resisted. They resisted for centuries. And so this was not a quick process, and it wasn't seamless by any means. It was actually very violent and bloody, and many people died, starved, and withered, certainly, in what were called the satanic mills in the industrial areas of jolly old England.
In the mid-19th century, British tariffs on imported grain were removed, opening the British Isles to imported grain. Was this the end of, or was this end of, British self-sufficiency in food production? Was this seen by elites as a problem?
Well, it depends on which elites. So if we're talking about the landed gentry, yes, this is a problem, because suddenly the grains and the wool and, you know, the things which they are producing for the market with the help of peasant labor are being undercut by, you know, grain from the Ukraine, for example. And so they're very much against this. But the British industrialists are very much in favor, because this cheapens the food basket. And they can then pay the workers relatively less, because food is less expensive. So, you know, there was a struggle, an interclass struggle between the gentry and the bourgeoisie, and the bourgeoisie won.
And the bourgeoisie won, and one thing that certainly helped the situation of food in the British Isles was the fact that Britain was going elsewhere for raw materials and fertile lands and crops, right?
Absolutely. You know, dual processes were going on. On one hand, British high farming was being developed. And high farming was simply a form of farming for the gentry, which relied on peasant labor, but also relied very much on guano, which is nitrate-rich bird droppings, which they had to import. So this was like the first green revolution, really. Rather than using chemical fertilizers, they were using guano. So on one hand, Britain is specializing in its agricultural sector on the island, and not necessarily to feed Britain, but also for export. On the other hand, the British Empire is expanding and conquering and exploiting and extracting all around the world. And so we have what's called the dawn of the first colonial food regime, which is, you think about a food regime as all of the institutions and all of the rules which govern food production and consumption. Now, it doesn't have to be complete. In other words, not everybody in the world has to do this the same way, but it does have to be hegemonic. And certainly the British Empire's food regime was hegemonic, as were some of the other colonial powers. And so what we get then is that the industrial North is able to industrialize, in part because they've dispossessed and exploited the peasantry on their own soil, but also because they dispossess and exploit the peasantry in foreign countries, which become their colonies. So the global South, or what becomes the third world, the colonies of Africa, Asia, and certainly Latin America, ship cheap raw materials and food to the North. And this is a huge subsidy to the North, allowing it to industrialize. And that's really what characterizes the global food regime. It was the time of the most overt acts of genocide and expansion, and the bloodiest forms of primitive accumulation.
Yeah, and you write about how crops like maize and potatoes and rice and sugar and tea, how important they were to early European capitalism. Rice, by the way, from Africa, plays an important role in cultivation in the, quote, New World. And slavery was, of course, a big part of that. You write that prior to slavery, capitalist agriculture failed to keep up with the growing demand for cotton because capitalists could not force the peasantry to grow it on an industrial scale. How did slavery change that picture?
Yeah, this is a common challenge for capitalism, is to get enough raw materials and to extract enough of this material wealth from the countryside when the countryside is held either by peasants or indigenous people. And they just can't get them to produce enough. And so then they have to conquer. You know, all of the cultivars, which you mentioned, became commodities, traded on global markets. And they all have a very sordid story behind them. Rice is especially heartbreaking because rice was grown by Africans who were experts at tidal irrigation, and they were also very good at milling the rice, which is a hard thing to do manually. And the Africans who were enslaved and put to work in the colonies had this knowledge. So rice, the knowledge of how to cultivate rice, comes over with Africans. And they did. And in the beginning, those who knew how to grow rice had to teach their masters how to do it. And they did this on the basis of exchange. There's evidence, very strong evidence, to suggest that early African farmers who had been enslaved negotiated for plots of land, negotiated for better treatment in exchange for growing rice. Unfortunately, when the masters learned how to grow the rice, that was all reversed. So that's a sort of a tragic story of what is, an endogenous crop, actually from Africa. We think all rice comes from Asia. It doesn't. This rice almost certainly all came from Africa.
Eric Holt Jimenez joins me. He is the director of the Institute for Food and Development Policy, known as Food First, and his new book is A Foodie's Guide to Capitalism, Understanding the Political Economy of What We Eat. It's published by Monthly Review Press. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Yeah, and just to read something from your book that kind of summarizes what you've been talking about, quote, "When we look at the emergence of the capitalist food system, we see that regulation in the form of the enclosures that privatize the production and flow of goods and the violent dispossession of land and resources by state-financed armies and the exploitation of labor by coercive means such as poverty and slavery allowed the system to emerge." So we've been talking about the first food regime, the colonial food regime, and you write that in the early 20th century, the first regime was replaced with a second global food regime. What happened during World War I and after to kind of shake things up?
Yeah, wars, particularly global wars, have a habit of really shaking up food regimes. So, you know, what happened is in the United States, after colonization and after independence and after the Civil War and the 13th Amendment and the liberation of enslaved people in the United States, is that steadily we begin to increase our productive capacity. And of course, the dispossession of indigenous lands and the slaughter of indigenous people continues apace as we spread across the continent. And this provides a tremendous sort of natural capital subsidy to the United States. Slavery has already provided tremendous, tremendous wealth to the financial system in the United States, and the government is able to borrow that in order to finance armies. Who are in the armies? Mostly dispossessed peasants from Europe. Anyways, we get this tremendous expansion and steady rise in productivity up to the point of the early 1900s. And in the early 1900s, when, you know, close to 80% of our population was rural, farmers were actually politically very powerful. It was called at that time the Golden Age of Agriculture, because farmers got prices which were commensurate with, you know, a good living wage. And it was called parity. And farmers basically had parity. Then comes the First World War, which was fought amongst the European colonial powers. The United States pretty much stayed out of it for the early period. And Europe buys steel from the United States, buys a lot of food from the United States. And so farming starts to boom. Farmers are actually getting rich. And then they take that money and they put it in the bank. And then the banks are flush with money from both Europe and the rural sector itself. Well, that's called a crisis of accumulation. The bank has to reinvest that money because they have to pay interest on that money. So they invested in agriculture. And so the price of land begins to skyrocket because it's so valuable, because you make so much money and you can borrow so much on it. So farmers took out, you know, one, two, three, four mortgages on their land and bought more land and produced more. And everybody was really getting rich until the armistice was signed, and then the party was over, because very soon after that, Europe began to produce food again and prices crashed. And it's not just that prices crashed for food, but for all of the other products which we had been selling Europe, and all the other products which we had been making for our own armed forces, which really got our economy moving. And that's when we get the 1929 crash.
Which must have added insult to injury at that point for farmers.
Yeah, well, they were the first crash. They were the crash before the crash, because their prices evaporated. And they desperately, this is the problem with farming, is that you have high fixed costs. And so if you go into debt one year because prices go down, the next year you don't cut back on production. You've got to pay that debt. And so farmers try to farm their way out of debt by planting more. But if everybody's got a debt and everybody's planting more because prices are low, all that does is crash the market. So farmers tried to establish forms of, you know, cartels for, you know, milk or wheat or beef or whatever, and they just couldn't do it. They're too far flung. They aren't organized enough. And in and of themselves, they weren't able to avoid the crash of agriculture, which preceded the 1929 crash. So it all came to a very inglorious end.
And then after the Great Depression, of course, we saw the New Deal in the U.S. You associate the dawn of the second global food regime with the New Deal.
Yes, absolutely. Because, you know, the government steps in to do what people can't do on their own, and what farmers as business people can't do on their own, and as producers can't do on their own. So the government steps in and institutes the New Deal. Well, the first part of the New Deal started with the food system. And the first was to ensure close to parity prices for farmers. So guaranteed price, build up grain reserves to maintain prices stable. If the prices go down too low, you buy up grain and put it in reserve and it raises prices. If prices are up too high, you release some grain on the market. It lowers prices, keep that stable. Farmers like that. And then they limited production. There were essentially quotas. You could only produce so much, and you were paid not to produce so that you wouldn't crash the market, so that the 1929-28 crash wouldn't repeat itself. And then with the surplus, which is being stored, the government gave away the food to poor people. Now, this didn't completely solve the problem, and we hear about the bread lines knee-deep in wheat as the United States was trying to pull itself out of the recession. But this introduces a new, completely new stage of state involvement in agriculture. And it's very clear that agriculture is critical to the general economic recovery of the nation. And again, we begin to enter into this area of increased productivity and agricultural expansion right on through to the Second World War. And this is the second food regime, which ends up producing so much food that after the Second World War, sort of the history repeats itself. U.S. gets in late to the into the action and makes a lot of money before the war, selling to Europe. But then after the war, Europe is destroyed, but the productive capacity in the United States has not been touched at all. In fact, it's increased, both in terms of agriculture and everything else. So we turn swords into plowshares, turn the nitrates into fertilizers, we turn the poison gas into pesticides, and we turn the tanks into tractors. And we begin to produce tremendous amounts of food. We include these in the Marshall Plan, and we feed Europe. Of course, Europe is borrowing all this money. But the next stage, then, we loan money to Europe so they can buy our equipment. So Europe modernizes its agricultural sector and begins to overproduce food, right when the U.S. is overproducing food. So what are we going to do with all this food? And the answer was development. We decided to save the world from hunger, and we began to ship food overseas as food aid, which was then sold, actually, in countries, poor countries, at prices which were below the cost of production in those countries, which put their local farmers out of business. And what we had then is a reversal. If the colonial food regime, the flow of food went from south to north, now the flow of food is going from north to south. In order for that to happen, they had to destroy the food systems, the markets and food systems in the south in order to absorb the tremendous surplus which was being produced in the north.
Eric Holt Jimenez is his name. He directs the Institute for Food and Development Policy. He's the author of Campesino a Campesino, Voices from Latin America's Farmer-to-Farmer Movement for Sustainable Agriculture, and co-author of Food Rebellions, Crisis and the Hunger for Justice. We are talking about his new book. It's called A Foodie's Guide to Capitalism, Understanding the Political Economy of What We Eat. We'll take a short music break and speak more with Eric about his very interesting book. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Eric Holt Jimenez is my guest. For more than two decades, he worked with peasant movements in Mexico and Central America. He's the author and co-author and editor of many books about food movements and land justice and food rebellions. And he directs the Institute for Food and Development Policy, also known as Food First. It's an Oakland-based organization that works to end the injustices that cause hunger. His new book is A Foodie's Guide to Capitalism, Understanding the Political Economy of What We Eat. There's so much in just this first chapter, Eric, that we're going to skip around a little bit. But the Green Revolution, which lasted from 1960 to 1990, it was a campaign to spread capitalist agriculture to the countries of the global south. So how much of this has to do with exporting farming-related inputs like fertilizers and pesticides and farm equipment to poorer countries, poorer nations?
Well, it has everything to do with that. And much less to do with ending hunger, as it was sold as the way to end hunger. And what we've seen with the Green Revolution, regardless of the Nobel Prizes that have been given away to some of the authors of the Green Revolution for ending hunger, saving a billion people from hunger, what we see, and this is sort of Food First's trademark, is that the Green Revolution produced as many or more hungry people than it saved. And, you know, the story has been very well documented. Ford and Rockefeller got together, so think about oil and machinery, and realized that neither Europe nor the U.S. could absorb any more of these products. Farmers had bought everything they possibly could. It's almost like food, you know. Once you're satiated, you can't really eat anymore. Mm. And they couldn't buy any more pesticides or fertilizers or new seeds or new tractors. It just wasn't feasible. So they decided to export, find a way to export these goods. And the first thing they did was they hired a man named Carl Sauer, who was an anthropologist here at the University of California, Berkeley, very renowned anthropologist who knew Mexico, certainly, backwards and forwards. They told Carl to go down and do a study on hunger in Mexico and how U.S. technology could solve the problem of hunger by raising yields. He did go down, and when he came back, he basically said they're doing fine. They have some infrastructure problems, and they have some difficulties in moving food from one place to another, but actually they have a very resilient food system. They have hundreds of different varieties of maize and beans and cultivars to feed themselves. They have an extensive ejido system in which farmers gain access to land and have land security in order to produce these crops. They have, you know, on and on and on. They sort of kind of had a New Deal plus going on in Mexico as a result of the Mexican Revolution. And he said, basically, stay away. You guys could probably do more damage than good. So they didn't like that answer. And they hired someone who would give them the answer they wanted, and that man was Norman Borlaug. He was a crop scientist from the Midwest. He went down and said, oh, we can fix this. And that's where he began developing dwarf wheats and whatnot that responded well to high applications of fertilizer and irrigation and to machinery. So the Green Revolution in the first instance is implemented on the best land in Mexico, and the best land in India, also in the Punjab. And, well, it has spectacular results. You know, they raise productivity, and then banks loan money from the U.S. to governments in the global south so that they can buy these new products. So it very quickly began to displace peasant agriculture again, very much like the high farming did back during the time of the enclosures. And the peasantry isn't able to afford these things, and so is steadily displaced, and larger plantations are established and consolidated. And then when the large landowners could no longer absorb all of these products, the Green Revolution shifted gears.
Right. They shifted gears, if I understand the book correctly, toward allowing peasant farmers to buy these inputs by lending them money.
Precisely. And this is really a big deal because, you know, before to borrow money, you needed to have collateral. And most peasants didn't have collateral. Many of them didn't own the land that they were on, or this was ejido land, which you can't use for collateral. This was all changed. And they just loaned the money directly to peasants and counted on the harvest for paying back. But this completely transforms peasant agriculture. For one thing, peasant agriculture was very agroecological. They had a lot of different cultivars growing at the same time in one place, very complicated crop associations that built resilience into the system. Well, with the Green Revolution, you buy one seed and you grow it on the entire plot. So even things as simple as the three sisters, corn, beans, and squash, was effectively prohibited. If you took out a loan and bought these seeds, you were not allowed to grow corn, beans, and squash. You could only grow the corn. So farmers did this. You know, they had already been displaced from the best lands to the poorest lands. So with this second iteration of the Green Revolution, and poor farmers are provided with the inputs, remember that we've almost doubled the amount of land under cultivation. So we have tremendous, tremendous flush of food on the market. And whenever that happens, the markets crash. And that's exactly what happened. The markets begin to crash. Peasants go out of business. Then, of course, the land consolidates again.
Yeah, and although you, as you indicated, initially yields were increased, yields from these fields and farms were increased, and there was a glut of basic grains as a consequence, there were impacts on the land, right, from synthetic fertilizer application and pesticide application and the planting of these hybrid seeds. What happened to the land?
Yeah, well, what happens is that because peasants are marginalized onto fragile lands, and this can be hillsides, forest frontiers, on the edges of deserts or arid areas, very quickly fertilizers burn up the organic matter in the soil, particularly in the tropics where the solar radiation is so much stronger that the metabolic processes are accelerated. So you lose your natural fertility very quickly. So then you have to add more fertilizer. And the more you add, sort of the worse it gets until you have essentially a mineral soil. That's exactly what happened to the peasantry. On the other hand, then, the minute you institute monocultural agriculture, when you grow only one crop, what you're doing is creating sort of a petri dish for pests. And they multiply rapidly, and then you've got to add more pesticides, and that just kills all of the beneficial insects and the predator insects, and so you get more pests. And it's called the agricultural treadmill or the chemical treadmill. And it's one thing to be on that treadmill if you're a big farmer, because you usually get bailed out with subsidies or forgiveness. But when you're a peasant farmer, no one bails you out. And so peasants were going broke, both because of the structure of the market, but also because of the ecological impact of the inputs they were being sold.
So the Green Revolution, you write, lasted until 1990. You also write about a third food regime, today's corporate food regime, which was built on the two food regimes that preceded it. So what's the relationship between the Green Revolution and the corporate food regime? And what do we need to know about the corporate food regime, the regime that exists and is hegemonic today?
What happens is that remember that the Green Revolution was a government-sponsored campaign. So these are public monies which go in to develop a far-flung network of international research centers for agricultural research. It's called CGIAR. So tremendous amounts of public money is plowed into the Green Revolution, really for the benefit primarily of large seed companies and fertilizer companies and farm machinery companies. But this exhausts itself. First, it exhausts itself ecologically because it's destroying the soil and destroying the agroecosystems and surrounding environments. And so the returns to the Green Revolution are fewer and fewer, and there's less and less interest on the part of government to fund this campaign. But then it also exhausts itself because basically the New Deal capitalism exhausts itself. And we enter into a period of neoliberalization starting in the late 80s, or starting in the 80s, with Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan beginning to roll back all of the social aspects of our governments and privatize everything. Well, this happened even more intensely in the global South, which has to do with the debt crisis, both in farming and of the global South in general. But the way to privatize then shifts not just the agriculture, but shifts entire societies, because what happens is that the global South was loaned money from private banks in the North to develop their forces of production. This very much included agriculture. But then when capitalism enters into a phase of overproduction and these products lose their value, the banks in the North decide they're going to call in their loans. And that's where we get the third world debt crisis, because countries can't afford to pay. That's also where we lose half of the farmers in the United States, because farmers go broke because they can't afford to pay, because their products are not worth anything either. So we get tremendous consolidation in the North. But in the South, how are you going to foreclose on Mexico? So that's when the structural adjustment policies were invented. So the World Bank would come in and say, you're behind on your payments, we'll loan you more money for your payments, but you have to sign a contract with this guy over here. And he was always a guy. And that was the International Monetary Fund. And the International Monetary Fund imposed structural adjustments. And these, for agriculture, were devastating. Because the first thing they said was, you must dismantle all of your grain reserves. You have to reevaluate your currency. You must put up all of your government agencies and programs for sale. And of course, agriculture during the Green Revolution depended on all of these agencies in order to extend its products. So we move into the next food regime in which agricultural ministries, for example, are almost completely privatized, which means that the peasantry is abandoned because larger farmers can afford to pay experts and extensionists, and the peasantry cannot. Food becomes very complicated. It's not just flowing north to south. It's flowing north to south, south to north, east to west. You have the vast, far-flung complexes like the grain oilseed livestock complex, where grains are grown, you know, in the Argentine pampas, and then they're turned into feed somewhere in the Midwest. And then we plow that into, you know, the hog and chicken farms and the big CAFOs, confined animal feedlot operations. And then we export that meat all over the world. So it gets very, very complicated, becomes completely corporatized. And we come into what we call either the corporate food regime or the neoliberal food regime, which is what we have today.
This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Eric Holt Jimenez is my guest in studio. He is the executive director of the Institute for Food and Development Policy, or Food First. His new book is A Foodie's Guide to Capitalism, Understanding the Political Economy of What We Eat. So there's much more in this book, an extraordinary amount of information offered in this book, A Foodie's Guide to Capitalism. But I want to turn to what you think as what you see as possible changes within the food system, changes to the corporate food regime, who might do this, how it might be done, what specifically needs to be done. So there is a food movement out there, a very active food movement on many different levels. What do you think, kind of in general terms, about where the food movement, what kind of change the food movement might be able to effect?
Well, the first thing we have to realize is that the corporate food regime is a capitalist food regime. And so it's going to act the way capitalism acts. And we know some things about capitalism. We've been studying it for over 300 years. And Karl Polanyi documented how capitalism goes through different phases, different periods. It bounces back and forth between periods of liberalism and periods of reform. And when he says liberalism, he means market liberalization.
Gotcha.
You know, taking the gloves off the market, no regulation. And you come into a period of tremendous concentration of wealth, but also into a period in which society is completely exposed to the market. People are unprotected by their governments from the volatility and the violence of the market. And so historically, what people have done is they rise up and they fight back. They make things so uncomfortable that, in fact, they forced reformists to institute reforms. This usually happens after a big crash when people are miserable. So we thought that this might have happened when we had the stock market crash here, in the financial crash in 2008, 2009, but nothing changed. In effect, the banks got bailed out, and that was it. There were no reforms. And what was the difference? The difference was that there was not a strong counter movement. And there was a social movement so strong that they could create political will to institute reforms, make the politicians do the right thing. Otherwise, they just do the thing that capital demands. And I think that when you look around the world, you see counter movements growing. And the food movement is, I believe, one of the prominent counter movements to capitalism, and it's a counter movement to the corporate food regime. And neither the corporate food regime nor the food movement is monolithic. There's a lot of diversity in both, but there are some trends, some very identifiable trends. So if the corporate food regime has a neoliberal wing, which is now quite hegemonic, they also have a reformist wing, which is now quite weak. food movements have a very progressive wing that is really grappling with the day-to-day difficulties of the food system. So that's where we see, you know, organic farmers, community agriculture, food policy councils, farm-to-school programs, all this plethora of, you know, fascinating responses to the injustices and the inadequacy of the corporate food regime, of our food systems. These are very practical folks.
Would you call them reformist? Are they pushing for reforms to the food system?
You know, primarily, I think the progressives are the doers. They're not terribly political, although we're beginning to see differences there. And as such, they're very easily co-opted by reformists from within the corporate food regime. I mean, there's quite a bit of money there, for one thing, and most community organizations don't have money. And so, you know, most of the sort of reformist foundations and reformist wings of government, you know, attempt to establish alliances with progressives because the reformists are weak.
And what do the reformists within the corporate food regime, what do they want?
Well, they basically want the same thing as the neoliberals, except they want safety nets. So, you know, EBT, you know, food stamps would be a safety net which reformists would defend, whereas neoliberals want to do away with it. Both believe in the food enterprise system, and they both believe in sort of the formula of overproduction and for getting things done. And they both believe in the power of corporations to solve the world's problems without really seeing how corporations themselves are the problem.
So what do you think of the tendency of the progressive trend within the food movement, or a significant part of it, to ally themselves with reformists?
Well, I think that it's a big mistake, because basically you're going to be reinforcing the corporate food regime. That's where they come from. I think that progressives are actually very pivotal. If they throw their weight and their alliances towards reformists, I believe the corporate food regime is strengthened. But if they throw their weight to who I'm calling the radicals, it's a different story. Because you think about the more radical trends within the food movement, these are the folks who want to change the rules and the institutions. They want agriculture out of the World Trade Organization. They want land reform. They want to dismantle the power of monopolies and corporate power. So they're really looking at the structures of capitalism, whereas the progressives are looking at the practices of farming. If these two are able to form strategic alliances, and I think we already see this happening, then the food movement is strengthened as a counter movement. And we know historically that the only way reforms will ever be introduced are through strong, powerful counter movements. And certainly if we're thinking about not just reforming the system to stabilize it, but transforming the system, then we really need to build these strong strategic alliances between the progressive and radical sectors of the food movement.
Within these sectors, there are a lot of NGOs, non-governmental organizations, CBOs, community-based organizations. What is it about the funding of these groups that might encourage or discourage a turn toward a radical agenda, a turn toward an agenda that includes changing things on a fundamental level?
Well, in a word, the foundations, I mean, the funding. The left has been fragmented, both because of its own errors, but also because of the money that it's received from foundations. The foundations, the whole structure of foundations and charities is to, you know, fund specific organizations, fund their SMART objectives and their, you know, sort of quantifiable results, and not to fund, you know, a more transformative movement building activities. And so what this does is it pits community organizations against each other. We're all competing for funding when we should be working together. But we have no choice because we have no money, and then the only place to get the money is from the foundations. And certainly there are a number of family foundations, I think, that recognize this and do try to support movement building activities and alliances. But in general, what we have seen for decades now is the fragmentation of the left.
Eric Holt Jimenez joins us to talk about his new book, A Foodie's Guide to Capitalism, Understanding the Political Economy of What We Eat. I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. You believe that the food movement can only succeed, the counter movement can only succeed, if it builds a critical public sphere. What do you mean by that?
We often don't think about the public sphere anymore, and that's because it's been destroyed. Neoliberalism over the past 30 years has not just privatized our public services, it's destroyed the community relationships that we have or that we had. This is the public sphere, that part of our society where we come together, we debate, we analyze problems, and we make decisions based on what we collectively believe to be right or to be best. We don't just let the market decide, because if the market decides, that means that whoever has the most market power is going to be making the decisions, and we know who that is. Those are the corporations. So it's no mistake that the public sphere has been decimated over the last 30 years. I talk to my students sometimes, and they don't know what a public sphere is. They're astounded to know that I went all the way through college and got my master's and my PhD without any debt whatsoever, through public scholarships, that there was public housing. And so part of our fragmentation under this supposed, entrepreneurial society that we have is our powerlessness and the illusion that we have powers as individuals when, in fact, we don't. We're completely being manipulated. And so reconstructing the public sphere, I think, is the first step towards building the social and political power that we need in order to change the food system. And I'll just give you a small example of where this is happening. The food policy councils. We have one here in Berkeley, we have one in Oakland and Richmond, and there are hundreds of them across the United States and Canada and in Australia, and they're popping up in Europe. So in the United States, it's really hard to change the laws and institutions around our food regime. You've got the Farm Bill. It's insulated by layer after layer of committee. They're not going to let any citizen touch that thing. That's for the politicians and the corporations to decide. But it sets the rules, and it sets the price of grain worldwide. Well, we can't change that today. We try and we try and we try, and there are basically no changes there. But we can change the food system at the local level. And so food policy councils are doing exactly that, bringing citizens together from all walks of life, small businesses, churches, the health sector, public health, et cetera. And they come together, analyze problems, and begin to advance policies, rules, and institutions that help to humanize our food systems. And I'm very proud of the food policy councils here in the Bay Area. They've really done tremendous work trying to make land available for cultivation for urban dwellers, finding ways so that urban farmers can sell their products, finding ways so that immigrants can start food enterprises, and really beginning to see, can we localize our food system and democratize it as much as possible? That's public sphere in action.
How crisis-ridden is neoliberal capitalism today, and how important is it that the food movement and other movements mobilize, particularly now, to take advantage of the situation?
We see plenty of crises, food crises, even though we produce 1.5 times more than enough food for everybody. We've got close to 2 billion people going hungry. And we have, 1 in 7 going hungry in this country, richest country in the world. That doesn't seem to affect Wall Street at all. And of course, we've got the global warming, and agriculture and the food system contribute anywhere from 20 to 40% of the greenhouse gases, either whether it's nitrous or whether it's carbon. So the crises are certainly here. And, in the past, when we were able to institute reforms, there was a crash, crises, a crash, and there was a threat. And the threat before was communism. And so Roosevelt institutes reforms in order to keep the United States from going communist. This time, I think the threat is global warming. and you can't establish detente with global warming. So we may be at the end of the line here. This might be the time where the concerns around food and the concerns around climate may well converge, and the crises around food and climate may well converge in such a way that we can get some real political traction and social traction to force changes upon the system.
Can what you call a good, clean, and fair food system, can that be constructed within capitalism?
Well, I think we have to look at the history. And, you know, what people who say that are basically proposing is that we fix the food system. And if you want to fix the food system, you have to ask, well, that means it's broken, but when did it actually work well? It certainly didn't work well when we dispossessed indigenous peoples of their land and engaged in mass genocide. That didn't work too well for indigenous people. It didn't work well for enslaved Africans. Certainly has not worked well for immigrant farm workers. So I don't think we can fix this broken food system. It's not broken. It's a capitalist food system. It's working exactly as a capitalist food system is supposed to work. It concentrates wealth and it offloads all of the externalities to the public, the vulnerable public. And that's what it's doing today. So no, I think the question to be asked is, it means we have to change everything. If we want to change the food system, we have to change everything. I think that because of the historic relationship of capitalism and our food system, they have co-evolved. If you change the food system, you're going to be introducing forcibly changes into capitalism. And then I think we also have to act to change capitalism itself in order to be able to change the food system that we have. So it's very much a dialectical process. It sounds daunting and overwhelming, and it is. And we don't know if this is going to work. We don't know how things are going to turn out. But we would know how things turn out if we do nothing, which I think we're heading for destruction.
Eric Holt Jimenez, Executive Director of the Institute for Food and Development Policy, known as Food First. Again, it's an organization that works to end the injustices that cause hunger, and we've been discussing his new book. It's called A Foodie's Guide to Capitalism, Understanding the Political Economy of What We Eat. Congratulations, Eric, on this book, and thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, C.S. A pleasure to be with you.
And you can find Food First on the web at foodfirst.org. And this is C.S. suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.